First thing I remember actually is buying a CD. Well, sorry, a tape it was back then. There was no fucking CDs. So yeah, it was Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction. And playing it over and over again. So that's my earliest memory is Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction.
Mate, I was talking to someone literally this morning about how whenever you got a movie on VHS, it kind of forced you to watch it a million times.
100%.
And you don't do that anymore.
No.
Like, even with your albums and stuff, like, I've become so shallow. I'm just like, listen to one, on to the next. Exactly. But, like, if you invested that money in that Guns N' Roses tape, like, you probably know every lyric on that album. Like.
Absolutely. The last time I listened to albums, like, you don't do that anymore. I was actually talking to my kids the other day and talking about, like, DVDs and Netflix and stuff. Yeah. And they were saying, like, Harry, they won't watch a film twice. Mm. And I was like, back when I was a kid, you used to have a guy who drove around the streets with a boot full of VHS tapes. Do you remember?
Yeah.
And this guy used to pull up and used to go and rent them on a weekly basis. Yeah. You know what I mean? And then obviously there was Extravision and all that. And they were like so far gone from that notion of doing that. 100%. And you maybe got the same tape every week.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And by the time you spent the £4 or £5 every couple of weeks to get it, you know, you may as well have just went out and fucking bought it, but they didn't.
100%. Mate, those guys were hustlers, though.
100%.
Like, serious entrepreneurs, like, just making it happen.
Don't fucking tapes in the boot of the car and driving around. Fucking genius.
So, if that Guns N' Roses tape was your album, what was your, like, movie or video?
Oh, good fucking question. Probably Goodfellas.
Oh, mate.
Yeah.
What a movie to have on repeat, like.
Goodfellas was always the one that I went back to. Like, even now, I'll still go back and watch Goodfellas. It's
Is that the
awesome.
One with the De Niro scene where it's like... Na, 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 na,
no,
na,
that's Casino, na. Isn't it?
I don't know. All the De Niro gangsters merge into one for me.
it's the one where Joe Pesci goes and stabs the fuck out of someone with a pen. You know what I mean? Like, that's awesome. What
heroic.
A film. Like.
Heroic.
Yeah.
Tell us about your band you were in.
Yes, so... I was in a couple of bands right up through school. I went into music and I played guitar, you know, and at that stage I was in St. Malachy's College and there wasn't really a basis for anyone who was sort of playing rock music and stuff. It was really classical. Yeah. And I used to play in the music department and used to get shouted at by the teachers, you know, you can't play that shit in here. And I used to just go in and fucking jam. And, so ended up teaching myself classical guitar just so I could play in there and used to use that, but I always had my electric guitar sitting. So obviously with the music department, there was a lot of people sort of banging about and formed a punk band back in the day. So we were called Ill Repute. We used to play in the local scene. Love you know that. What I mean? So Gyros, the Front Page, like all the old bars, Auntie Annie's. And... but it was all covers and fucking about and just getting too drunk and it was pretty cool. Like, so got a bit more serious into it and joined a band called 30 Pieces. And it was like, we've done all our own stuff, you know, so it was all like middle of the road rock, like Pearl Jam-esque sort of stuff. And we'd done pretty okay. Like, I mean, we were touring. We actually were hanging about drunk outside the Limelight across the street and got chatting to a band called 1 Minute Silence. Just happened to have a tour bus and we talked our way into the tour bus and started like playing a couple of songs for them just outside. And they invited us over to London.
Right.
Yeah. And started like saying, listen, would you go on and would you play and support us? And we're like, fuck yeah, of course. Brilliant. They were giving us like £500 a fucking gig.
Bro. Back and then, at that point you were like, did we just sign a deal?
100%. It was like the best thing ever.
Yeah.
So we've done a handful of gigs with them around London, one in Dublin as well. And yeah, it was fucking unreal. Like getting paid to be in a band, it was like,
what was your check size before that? Like 50, 100 quid?
Fuck, are you lucky?
30?
Yeah, we got nothing. We got nothing. I remember one time we played for Johnny Hero in the Duke of York, upstairs in Duke of York. And he bought us like 4 pints afterwards. Hilarious. That was like, we thought we'd made it
and
then.
You were chuffed.
100%. 4 pints.
You're like,
fuck,
you know, really,
great.
You really shouldn't. Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, you look at it now, it's complete exploitation.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But yeah, at the time, you know, you're just looking to play music in front of people. It was cool. Like,
so how do you end up, and I love the way you phrase this, loosely opening for Motorhead?
Yes. So I tell this to people all the time. I supported Motorhead in the loosest possible terms, you know. So again, complete fluke. 1 minute silence. We're playing a festival in Dublin called the Extreme Fest. It was in the RDS.
Nice.
And Motorhead were headlining. So they invited us down and stuff like that. And they said to us, a band had pulled out that were supposed to open. And they were like, listen, you guys don't have your own stuff, but would you just jump on? We're like, fuck, yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah, so like we jumped on at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, had a sound check and just went straight on. We done 25 minutes. And literally, there was like cleaners walking about the place and people setting up. And I think there was maybe like 20, 30 people in the place all together. But we supported fucking Motorhead.
Hey, claim it.
Do you know what? I'm claiming it. 100%. Yeah, yeah. Motorhead played later that night, but I did get to meet Lemmy.
Did you?
I did. Yeah, so Lemmy was upstairs. Obviously, we were in the VIP area upstairs, where the artists were. And run about with an artist pass, it was fucking, what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, we were talking ourselves into clubs in Dublin afterwards, and it was unreal. But, yeah, so Lemmy came up and was drinking fucking bottles of Jack Daniels in true Lemmy fashion and got to say, how's it going, Lemmy? And he says, how are you doing, young man? And walked away. So
epic, mate.
Job done.
Epic. So I feel like I've just met you, so I know very little about you, you know very little about me. But I feel like every friendship group has somebody who just somehow manages to get themselves in situations and meet people.
Yep.
How did you end up having beers with Johnny Depp?
Yeah.
Like, what is that? Like,
I know. That was the most rat. Like, I am honestly that guy who can just, I talk my way into things. Yeah. And I used to work security and stuff. Nice. So I did. And was working down at Oxygen. And fell out with the manager who was like, basically bullying people. Right? And I sort of had a bit of an umbrage against it. And I was like, that's not right. And I ended up walking off. I said, fuck yous. And away I went. But I walked into the VIP bar. And obviously had the security pass, so just walked on in.
Yeah.
And I knew the guy that was doing behind the bar because he worked in the Limelight. And he's like, do you want a beer? And I was like, fuck it, I'll have a beer. So Stan having a beer. And I said, listen, give that other fellow a beer who was standing at the bar. And it turned out it was fucking Johnny Depp. I didn't know. So he fucking turned around and came over. And we were drinking Bacardi Breezers.
Unbelievable.
That's all they had. Pineapple Bacardi Breezers and Johnny Depp. Yeah, so he came over and he was like, thanks for the beer. And I was like, holy fuck, I didn't realize it was you.
Amazing.
And yeah, he stood talking away for about 20 minutes, shooting the shit. And then he went and jumped on a helicopter and fucked off.
Class.
So yeah.
Mate, that is just epic. So that, like, I don't think you'll take offense, but saying the gift of the gab, right? The ability to talk, the ability to interact with people. Is that something that you had since you were young, or is that something that you developed?
I worked in bars my whole life.
So that's the training ground?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I had to deal with drunk people and de-escalate situations, you know. And I always say, if you can negotiate against someone who's got a broken bottle looking to stab you in the face, you can do any sort of business deals that you want, you know.
100%.
So, it's definitely about having the gift of the gab and being able to talk to someone. I've always had that, you know, and that's something that's always stood by me.
Where were you born and bred?
Belfast.
Epic.
So, yeah, North Belfast, born. Grew up on the Whitewell Road. My dad owned bars. So yeah, he owned two local bars in Greencastle, just off the Whitewell Road. And I worked in those from I was like 11 years of age.
Yeah, that's in early, like.
Yeah. Yeah. You're always told, you had to have a work ethic.
You do, yeah.
And you had to go in and it was just, stocking shelves and cleaning ashtrays and stuff at the time because that was still a thing. And
of course it was.
Yeah, so going in and just doing all the sort of the labor around the place that we had to do.
Yeah.
And then just starting in the bar when you were 16,
Yeah, 100%. So were you one of the guys that, did you like work?
I mean, to be honest, I can't remember not working.
Of course, yeah.
It's always been a part and you've just always had to go to work.
Yeah.
And working for my dad, I think it really instilled a work ethic in me where, you couldn't just, couldn't just phone in sick. Like, mates were always saying to me, like, phone in sick. Like, even when I had genuine, like, illnesses and, like, I broke my arm one time and I still go into work. You were never able to throw a sickie because your dad knew exactly where you were.
That's the owner mentality, isn't it?
Exactly.
Like, it's if you don't work, you don't get paid.
100%.
You know?
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, and if someone doesn't go into work, businesses don't open, people don't get paid. Mm. And that's the bottom line. It's about having that mentality instilled into you.
Did you find it hard to take school seriously when you already kind of had a career?
100%.
Yeah, it's tough too.
That was difficult. Flip side, isn't it? Exactly. You know, you kind of thought, why should I? You know, I've got this.
I mean, I'm already making bank.
Exactly. You know, I mean, back when I was in school making like 100 quid a week and all, and like, you know, you're looking back at it and going like, fuck me, I'm loaded. But obviously, young and dumb, and you don't understand that life comes with so much more than that.
I remember like my first job was in hospitality. I was a busboy, and I remember getting my first paycheck and it was like 130 quid. And I remember literally thinking, oh my goodness, in 1 week, I've just got all the money for an iPod Touch. And like, that used to take me a year to save up for.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? It was amazing. You felt like a millionaire.
Yeah, 100%.
So, what did you do in school? Did you get out as soon as you could? Did you stick around?
Yeah, I got out as soon as I could.
Were you interested in any subjects?
I was more of a daydreamer, to be honest. I didn't really apply myself. Always kept getting this. Kieran has loads of potential, but does fuck all, basically. I done okay at school, but I just decided not to apply myself. You know, I remember doing religion, and I'd done this bit of coursework that I actually applied myself to. Mm. And there was a substitute teacher who was taking us at the time, and it was like your GCSE coursework. But she fucked off with all her GCSE coursework and brought it to Vietnam when she moved away, and they were like, you have to do it again.
No.
I was like, fuck that, I'm not doing it. And I just didn't do it. You know what I mean?
Crazy.
And got a U in religion because I thought, oh, fuck it, I've done it, so I'm not doing it again. You know?
100%. So you leave school, what happens?
Mm-hmm. Left school and went into work. Started just working full-time in the bar. And it was okay, you know, obviously working unsociable hours. Mm. And my days off were sort of Monday, Tuesday. So, you know, you fit it. It was a different lifestyle than everyone else, but you sort of made it work with people in the industry.
Yeah.
You know, you fall into that sort of trap where you're working away and everything's going okay. You're getting a wage and it seems to be a steady path. And then really the recession came and bars went shoosh.
Yeah.
So, you know, my dad started falling into difficulties. The bar started going. I was like, shit, I'm going to have to do something here.
Mm.
No qualifications, no plans, you know. And it was like literally had to take stock of what was happening and try to come up with my own plan because the security of a family business wasn't there anymore, you know. And my dad unfortunately lost the bars. Mm. And it was just kind of like, right, you have to just go and find something.
What did that do to you seeing him lose that?
It was a lot to take in.
Because that's brutal.
Absolutely.
Because you know yourself now, like your business really becomes your extra kid.
Absolutely. You know? No, of course. Like, and even now, looking back on it, you know, it hurts even more looking back because you understand what he went through. You know, at the time, obviously, everyone was blaming themselves. What could I have done better? But you look at it now from a sort of macroeconomic point of view.
It's 2008. What the hell are you going
to
do?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, like, people just weren't spending money anymore. They weren't going to the bars. Like, the whole drinking culture had changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this local bar wasn't the same. People were having pre-drinks in the house and then going out really late. And if you have a local bar, you were relying on that day trade.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
People, workers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
People coming in and spend their week's wages in the bar on a Friday night. You know, you can't look back at it now and go like,
but that was reality.
That's what we,
and it was for like 100 years.
Exactly. That's what people done. You know, so you kind of thought, and it was always a path that I just assumed that was in front of me.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, reps from Guinness and stuff were talking about when you take it over, we'll finance this, and there was always a path, and then all of a sudden that path was taken away.
Wow.
So, you know, it was a lot.
So what do you do? Did you move to London?
Well, no, not right away. I started working in recycling. So I did. So what I basically done was look at industries where there was going to be growth. You know, I was looking at it going,
you're like, I'm not going to get screwed ever again.
Exactly.
You know, recycling's going to be here for 1,000 years. Let's go, baby.
Exactly. You know, so that was the plan. It was to look at something that wasn't going to change, that there was always going to be an upside. And to be honest, there was a lot of stuff that I looked at, death being one of them, you know, the death trade, stuff like that, stuff that was always going to be around. And I was like, you know what, recycling. Yeah. And I talked my way into a recycling company, a really, really small recycling company based in Mollusk. And I started as a sales and marketing manager for them.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Because I'd done a bit of promotion online, you know, with the bars and stuff. So I had an understanding of social media right in the early days, you know. And
that is, that's at the cusp there.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we were starting to look into that and you know, even just advertising locally, you know. So stuff like that was on the rise. So just really leveraged that to talk my way into a job.
Brilliant, mate. And so, like, what was your takeaways from that chapter?
It was definitely like, you know what, you have to create your own path. Mm. You know, like, for once, it was about me standing on my own 2 feet rather than relying on other people around me. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was a big takeaway from it. And then just really leaning on your strengths. Mm-hmm. You know, like, stuff that you were good at. Like, I knew I could talk my way into anything. So, mm-hmm. you know, it was just going and using that. And then, you know, trying to learn. You know, it was all about learning. So got pretty decent. You know, we started doing really well. They were a small manufacturing company that subcontracted in the other jobs. And I basically went around looking at different manufacturers who were manufacturing, and I went and tried to sell services to them, you know, and it done really, really well. But what it got me on is the radar of other people. Mm. People started seeing that stuff was going okay, and I got chatting to a supplier who basically supplied crushing and screening equipment into the UK,
which is a much bigger thing than I previously thought it was.
Unreal.
Like, in this part of the world,
exactly.
Like, it is humongous.
People don't realize.
Someone gave me a ridiculous stat. I'm not going to repeat it because I'll butcher it. But they were like, "Did you know that like X percentage of like crushing machinery like comes out of Tyrone or something?" Exactly. I was like, "What?
40% of the world's crushing and screening equipment is made in Tyrone."
That's it. That's crazy. The stat. Yeah. I have no idea who told me that, but I've remembered it. Yeah, loosely.
It's true. Yeah, and I had never heard of this. You know, being from Belfast, I didn't fucking Tyrone. Owns a million miles away from me, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Like there's a whole other world down there, and that's really what was shown to me. It was talking to people in the industry and seeing these machines that were taking huge rocks and crushing them down into smaller rocks. I had no idea even what the fuck they were doing with them, you know what I mean, at the start. And then it was like you started to learn more and more about it, and it just opened my eyes to a whole new world. Yeah. And yeah, he offered me a position that involved me being in England all week, and I was going to be traveling back and forward, you know, so going over Monday to Friday selling machinery and then coming home at the weekends.
Mm.
But at the time, you know, the salary that he offered was crazy for me, you know.
Yeah.
Coming from a 250 pound a week.
Sure.
As you know, that was awesome in hospitality. You got cash in hand and everything was cool.
Yeah.
And then you're getting offered a real salary, and it was a chance to do something. So in an industry that you just seen so much potential in. So totally, you know, I really jumped at it.
Crazy.
Yeah.
When did you meet your partner?
I met her actually. So I guess there's probably part of this that I haven't spoke about. So I trained in martial arts most of my life. And
What art?
Karate, nice. Predominantly. But then I transitioned into mixed martial arts right at the start. And very I had good. A few...
Smart move.
Yeah. I had a few MMA fights and stuff like that. And with having obviously an ability behind the bars and talking to people, I ended up doing the door.
Epic.
Randomly. It started in London actually. So it did. And that was back to the part of... Sorry, this is all over the place.
It's all good. Yeah. They always are.
Yeah. So when I was in the band and we sort of traveled with 1 Minute Silence over to London, we had a massive fallout with the band, mm-hmm. As all bands do, eventually implode.
Any good band.
Yeah. So we had a massive fallout. At the time, you know, this is how naive we were. When we traveled over to London to sort of travel around all it, we didn't even have anywhere to live. We just went in the back of a van, and we threw a mattress into the back of a van, and mm-hmm. four of us lived in a mm-hmm. van driving around London trying not to get clamped.
Epic.
So I was like, you know what? Someone has to get a job here. So being an Irish fella in London who had worked in the bars was like, I'll get a job in an Irish pub.
Yeah, easy.
So ended up working in a bar called Waxy O'Connor's right outside Trafalgar Square, and cracking bar, and just started working away. And I remember one time there was a thing called Pop Idol, used to be the thing before X Factor.
I remember, and Will that. Young, Garth Gates.
Yeah, all them guys, remember, yeah. So there was a guy called Pete Snedden, who was like the first guy to ever win it.
Off-brand Pete Snedden, not my joke.
I always have to get those two names. So Pete Snedden won, and he was drinking in the bar. And I always have an ability to figure out when fights are going to happen. Mm. You know, the atmosphere changes in bars. I'm working in them from a young kid. You know, you can tell.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so
it's like a spider sense.
It really is. Like, wow. Like even in bars now, my missus, I would say, watch him.
Really?
Yeah.
So like, if you could like distill it even remotely, because I know it's really hard to articulate instinct and gut feelings. Mm-hmm. But like, what is it that you think you're seeing?
You can read people's body movements, how to change. You can read how they interact with other people. Yeah. You know, body language changes. You can see tension, you can see agitation, yeah. You know, stuff like that. You can start to see people changing.
Man, I love that. What a nugget.
Yeah. So I started to see this, and I was like, this fellow was like buzzing around your man, Pete Snedden. And I was like, walking around. I remember my manager saying to me, Kieran, get back in the bar. Yeah. And I was like, two seconds.
Just wait.
And then this guy went for him, and I grabbed him, put him in a headlock, and just trailed him out the door.
Epic.
And the doormen were like, what the fuck? I was like, there you go, lads. And we're like, how the fuck did you do that?
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I've done a bit of training and stuff. And says, well, what, have you a background in martial arts? I says, yeah, I've trained in karate and stuff like that. And they went, do you want to come back tomorrow night and work on the door? I was like, and it was like,
they all just like get down on their knee and like offer you like a pepper spray. They're like, need us.
Yeah, it was really mad because like these were all like 6'4", huge guys. Like, yeah. I mean, most of them worked, you know, as extras in films and stuff, in the Guy Ritchie films and stuff. You know, huge guys.
All bald.
Yeah, they really were. and I was like a, you know, 19, 20, something like that. Wet behind the ears kid from Belfast, sure, standing on the door with these guys, you know. Yeah. But it was like £25 an hour. And I was like, what?
Unbelievable.
So I was like, fuck yeah, wow. I'll do it. So yeah, started working on the door. And now short-lived, but, you know, I was there for about 4 weeks. And I was working on the door. So working for some crazy dudes as well.
Tell me about him.
Yeah, so the guy who, so it turned out that this guy, his name was Harry, and he was the guy who just sort of came around at the end of the night, handed wages, and then left. You didn't really see too much of him. But in talking to the other guys, they were like, have you ever seen Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels? Mm. I was like, yeah, obviously. And he says, that's the guy that Hatchet Harry's character is based on.
Crazy.
This guy's a fucking killer. And I was like, oh my God. And like, you kind of looked at him, he's a huge, big guy, you know.
Yeah.
Heavy, bald head, real knuckle dragger, you know, but quietly spoken, like you never heard him speak like. Mm-hmm. And I remember one day in the bar, there was an incident upstairs where 30 people went, like big lads went upstairs, and they were taking like drugs off the table and stuff.
Yeah.
And a couple of doormen were like, we'll go up. And they says, no, wait, Harry's coming down. So all the doormen had to stand and wait. And as Harry walked up the stairs, the rest of the doormen went to go up with him. And he says, no, I'll go by myself.
Bro.
And he walked upstairs, sat beside one of them, whispered in his ear, got up, turned around, and they all just cleared their stuff and got up and walked away. And he just got into his car and drove away. It was like one of the scariest things I've ever seen.
Badass.
Completely. It was honestly like something out of one of those Guy Ritchie films. Like, jeez, crazy.
Louise. So where are we? What's the thread? Your partner?
Yeah, so I then came back and started doing the doors in Belfast.
Right.
So I did, and worked, you know, because obviously making, you know, money working in the bars and stuff, but supplementary income and all that sort of stuff, life started getting a lot dearer. And yeah, so met my partner actually in a door in West Belfast.
Epic.
So yeah, it was the Blackstaff Bar in the Springfield Road. I was doing the door one night. And she came in and got chatting outside, and yeah, we've been together ever since.
Yeah, I love that. How many kids? You have a few, don't
we? We have three kids.
Unbelievable.
So we do, yeah.
Class.
Three kids.
While we're kind of out of our flow here, we may as well tell us about your distant relative from Donegal.
Yeah.
So is that a family story? Is that like, does that do the rounds in
it,
your family?
It does the rounds all the time. You'll hear it pop up at weddings and funerals.
Does it like
and stuff
grow?
Like
does it change and morph?
It doesn't have to.
It's so strange.
It doesn't have to. So yeah, I've these cousins, distant relations. I'll not mention their names, but they basically went to Donegal for a family holiday.
Right.
And it was my grandmother's sister and her family. So they went away to Donegal on a family holiday, and unfortunately, she died while they were there. And obviously they had went up, and she died of natural causes, you know. So they went up in the morning to try and wake her up, and she was dead. So obviously there was the initial emotional reaction to that. And they were like, right, what do we do? And someone said, right, we'll phone the ambulance and phone the guards. And then they were like, hold on a second. She's on disability. She's on disability benefits. She shouldn't have left the house. And they went, oh, shit, what do we do? So they put her into the back of the car and drove her back to Belfast. And she went to Ballymurphy, and they phoned the police station in Ballymurphy to tell them then that she had died. And they never mentioned that she was actually in Donegal. And they drove with their dead mother in the back of a car.
Mate, that's so brutal.
Crazy.
But you gotta do what you gotta do.
Do you though? I don't know.
Yeah, that's absolute madness. Oh man. So, right, you are selling crushing machinery. You're back and forward in London. What happens after that?
Yeah. So, what I started to do was see like how many inefficiencies there were in how we were selling, like. I knew a lot of salespeople that were doing exactly the same thing. You know, a lot of people moved over from Ireland and were selling crushing and screening equipment all over England. So in driving around, like my area was the whole of Britain and Scotland, you know. So I was literally driving around the whole region. We were a small unit with a lot of ground to cover, you know. And literally the direction was drive around. And if you see a recycling center, call in and hand the business card and try to sell.
Epic.
And that's what you do.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool call.
Exactly. And like there was times like I was chased out by dogs, and like you go to these skip power centers, you know, some of them are rough and ready.
Sure.
And you know, it was really, really difficult. So this was, you know, I started thinking, you know, there has to be an easier way to do this.
Yeah.
And what I sort of looked at was, again, going back to the sort of marketing angle and using digital, I started looking at the website. You know, we had a decent website, got it made really well, and we started, you know, pumping it out a bit, and we were getting a lot of sort of hits off the website and people going looking at machinery. So what you could do was just reverse IP search people that were on the website, and you know, if they'd be registered to a business listing, then you could see who was buying.
Very good.
Using that information to go and say, you know, this guy from this green waste facility in York was on your website last night.
Yeah.
So I drove to York and like went in and like handed it, and they used to be like, fuck, I was on your website last night. I was like, no way.
That's
really?
Like when people are like, do you think my phone's listening to me? Yeah. You were like, yeah, it is.
Exactly. Exactly. So yeah, so that's what I started doing. And
that's
like
guerrilla marketing at its finest.
Yeah, you know, and it was something that no one else was doing. And I was like, fuck, I'm onto something here.
Yeah.
So started selling really, really well because of it. And so I decided that, you know what, there's definitely legs here.
Yeah.
Like there's a whole digital element to this industry that no one is going for. Yeah. So wanted to learn a bit more about it. And I seen an opening for a marketer in a manufacturer in Tyrone called Anaconda. And I applied for it. And the CEO called me and says, Kieran, I know you're from the industry. I would like to chat. So I went down and sort of got talking to him and said, listen, you know, this is what I was doing in terms of reverse IP searching, and I think there's a whole world in digital that we could go for. And he was like, I love it. I think this is something that we could really use. So he offered me a job, and I took it. And what that allowed me to do as well, obviously, with you know, the missus in the house and the kids, it settled back in Ireland again, you know, where I wasn't traveling over again, because obviously it's difficult, you know, raising
gets
a family.
Really tough, really quick.
Of course, you know, and being on the road that amount of time is really, really stressful. So, you know, took a job over here with a manufacturer with the idea of learning from a manufacturer's perspective what difficulties and problems they were coming up against. And it was completely littered with opportunity. Mm. And that's what was completely evident, you know, because I was when I was selling in England, I was what's called a machinery dealer that manufacturers used to sell through. It's about having like local boots on the ground.
Yeah.
So in going working for the manufacturer, it was then, right, go find dealers to sell through, you know. So it was a different sales process. We weren't going after the end user anymore.
You're looking for the connector.
We were, exactly.
But it's a bigger fish, because if you get the dealer, you could sell a ton of machinery.
Exactly.
Nice.
Exactly. You know, but what we were doing then was competing against everyone else, mm-hmm. because there's people that made similar machines all going for the same dealer, and there's a finite number of dealers out there.
Yeah.
So we're all chasing the same fish, you know, and what that leads is manufacturers don't promote their machines. if they get a dealer, say in Texas, they don't promote that because they're scared of someone else coming and trying to steal them from under their feet.
Progress.
You know, so they're like, I'm going like, you have dealers there and you won't tell people about your machines. You're not getting it out there.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't want other people find out.
Like, interesting mindset, isn't it?
Completely.
Yeah.
You know, they're always scared of other people looking over the fence.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Real close-minded mentality. You know, and you can see because, you know, originally when this started in Tyrone, you know, in the 60s, it was one company that was making these, and then there was all these breakaway companies from that company, you know, so everyone was stealing the same ideas and the machinery, and it's still got that heart still there, you know?
Yeah.
And it's infected the whole industry right now.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So then I'm going to cut this bit if I get this wrong to save face. Did you have another business before Machinery Partner?
I did.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, so doing the doors and stuff around Belfast, I obviously, again, was seeing that managers were really struggling with door staff.
Yeah.
And I was like, do you know what? Like, the problem here is they need people there to do the doors, obviously, because of numbers. But there's a big admin problem and managing the amount of door staff and managing all that. So I just went to them and said, listen, see, finding door staff, I can do that for you. I'll start a company. And it was a company called Belsec Security. And I went to these managers and said, listen, I have an app that can manage all this for you. And they were like, what do you mean? I says, you just tell me how many door staff you need and I'll automate everything for you. And they were like, really? I was like, yeah. Incident reports, everything will all just automatically come. You'll not have to chase anything. They're like, fuck, this is great. So yeah, I started doing that. And
you're scratching my itch, bro. It's like, yeah. This will save me a lot of headache.
Exactly. So yeah, so I went around and started selling that, and bar started buying it.
Wow.
You know, so
once. How'd you learn to do that? Because so far, in what you, I mean, obviously your story's humongous beyond what we can cover in a podcast. But based on the information you've told me, you don't strike me as like a Zuckerberg type that's like can do all this stuff.
Absolutely not. I mean, and this wasn't something that I built.
Yeah.
You know, all this was a Trello board.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you serious?
100%. It was a Trello board. And I just created different Trello boards for different bars.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was a project management tool. You know what I mean? This wasn't anything that wasn't out there anyway. But they thought because I had this app that it was my app. And it wasn't. It was just a Trello board. So it was a project management tool. I just organized stuff and allowed them to keep track of everything.
I'm genuinely... like, so I have a huge smile on my face. I'm so surprised but so in awe at that.
It was the easiest way, you know. It's like they have a problem, what's the easiest way to fix it? And that's literally what it was.
Wow. So what was the end bit of the journey for that?
Yeah, so basically started taking over, you know, at one stage we had 8 or 9 bars around Belfast, and a competitor came and offered me $50,000 to buy it off me, and I was like, fuck yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, so they basically took my contracts. I got $50,000 and I was like, this is unreal.
And like in the Trello board form?
Yeah, I just...
Are you serious,
yeah,
bro?
Yeah, it was just, man, Trello board, and I just so transferred awesome. Contacts and they got all the contracts. They bought over Belsec and just dissolved it and away they went.
So like that in itself is hugely impressive. And I'll come back to that. I think I'll come back to that a wee bit later. Give us your bit on then starting Machinery Partner. Did you do this while you were working for the other company, or at what point did you make the leap?
Yeah, so basically, when working for Anaconda, we were running about chasing the same dealers as everyone else.
Yeah.
So I wanted to understand how we could get dealers better than anyone else.
Yeah.
So it's again just looking at that need and using the sort of digital element to do that. So we started targeting the end users. So directly marketing towards the end user and saying, right, you need this machinery and
so
generating
leads.
Cut
out the middleman.
We did, but we used that to generate the middleman.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what we done was then go, like, say it's California, for example. We'd spend 3 weeks deep diving and marketing into that area, generating a load of leads, and then going to a dealer and saying, listen, we would love for you to sell our equipment. By the way, there's 50 people who are looking at machines in your region right now.
That's so good.
Yeah, you know, so that was really, really successful. And Anaconda ended up boosting their revenue by 47% in just 18
Jeez
months.
Louise.
Yeah.
Wow.
That led to them being acquired by a company called the McClanahan Corporation.
That's how you know you're doing a good job. When the company literally does so well, someone else buys them.
Exactly.
My goodness.
You know, so they got acquired by the McClanahan Corporation. And the McClanahan Corporation offered me a role heading up their digital marketing.
Yeah.
Based in the US. And at the time, I remember Kalena, my better half, was pregnant. Mm. She was 6 months pregnant with our latest child. And I was like, fuck this, Kalena.
Yeah.
And she went, what do you mean? This is they offered like, you know, huge salary and stuff. Like, yeah. Like it was insane. And I was like, I've got something here.
Mm.
And she says, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And she went, you're going to leave? And yeah, it's a perfect opportunity to jump out and start this. I said, I've seen an opening that no one else is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than taking the salary, I just decided she was pregnant and I just jumped out and left and started my own thing.
Brilliant, mate.
So yeah, that's where it started.
Wow. And I mean, like, to fast forward a little bit, because I know we could spend a few hours on your machinery partner journey.
Mm-hmm.
I am not an entrepreneur. I have no concept of your industry.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a story guy. And see the pure story of that you hustled for years and years and years at this Belsec security thing.
Mm-hmm.
You sold it. And now you've a business that turns over at least a month.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is insane.
Yeah, I mean,
like, that is absolutely incredible.
It's just filling a need. You know what I mean? There's so many people out there that use these machines to process material. Mm. You know, and the big thing we realized is, you know what? We don't sell machines, we sell revenue. You know, when our customers come to us,
mate, that is so good.
It is, you know, like it's not machinery they're looking
so
to buy.
True.
It's revenue. We're just helping them to buy more revenue.
You're selling them multipliers.
Exactly.
Wow.
And that's what we're looking at the machinery. It's not like, right, I want a crusher off you. No. What material do you use? You know, and it's like concrete. Okay, so what are you looking to crush down to? I take it with concrete, you're looking to crush it down to 1.5 inches and use it for fill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's exactly. Okay, so, you know, typically in the US, it'll be like $20 a ton, mm-hmm. you know, and we talk to them in that sort of terms.
So you're basically like, how much money do you want to make? How quickly do you want to process stuff?
Exactly.
Here's the machine that can allow you to do that.
Exactly.
It's just so smart.
It's just a return on investment calculation. You know, that's what it is. They talk to you in material and you talk to them in revenue. And that's what it is. So it's that realization that customers are coming to you, not for the machine, but for the ability to grow their own business.
Yeah.
And we help facilitate that.
Yeah. So I know it's a bit of a trope, a bit of a cliche in like the startup world, where like every startup has now become, oh, it's Airbnb for X or it's Uber for X. The first time I heard of Machinery Partner, and you can tell me if you like this description or you don't, they said, oh yeah, it's like Tinder for big machines.
You know, 100%. That used to be my pitch for ages.
Was that your pitch?
That was my pitch, Tinder for diggers.
Unbelievable.
Is what I used to pitch it to people. Short and snappy. But yeah, you know, it's about matching, you know, and that's what it is. It's matching machinery to your needs.
Yeah.
And that's what it is.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's so much more elements to it now. I mean, as we've seen this business grow, there's so many more elements to it. You know, financing is a huge thing, you know, so helping these, because the businesses we're really targeting, they're not people that are established in their market.
Yeah.
You know, it's small businesses.
Yeah.
You know, sort of $2 to $10 million a year businesses, maybe $20 million a year businesses. You know, like family run businesses who don't have a procurement department. So they're coming to us looking for a machine. It's like, you know, most of the time they don't even realize what they're looking for. They're looking at the wrong machine.
Yeah.
We help them pick the right one. And then they're like, how do we pay for it? And a lot of these guys, you know, they have money in the bank and they're like, right, it's $300,000. Yeah, there's $300,000 right there. And we're like, no, don't do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You be smart with your money. Spread this out, you know, and they're
like, you're better taking a mortgage, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So spreading that money out and using that capital for something else in their business, you know, so... It's really become this process where we're working hand in hand with these small businesses. And that's where Machinery Partner came from.
Yeah.
You know, it's really partnering with these companies to help them do better and grow.
So again, my only window into a remote kind of context of all this, and perhaps for some of the people listening, you know, is Clarkson's Farm.
Yeah.
So Clarkson's Farm has shown a lot of non-farming people like myself the cost of machines. And like, not every farmer or every farming family is Jeremy Clarkson that can just buy like $100,000 tractor
exactly.
for the crack. And you know, these businesses, like, it's so the fact that they could lease something or rent something or do it on finance just makes so much more sense for them.
Exactly. The problem is, you know, the majority of our business is based in the US at the moment. The whole credit score system in the US is completely broken. You know, so companies are scored based on their own credit, you know, so the company's owner's credit, not the viability of the business. Yeah.
That is bonkers.
It's insane, you know. So a lot of these guys, you know, they may have been dinged in their own personal credit. They may have been through, you know, problems in the past.
Sure, yeah.
But their businesses are really profitable. Really? They've got all this money in the bank, but they just can't get, you know, and that's really the problem that we're looking into now. You know, it's like, do you know what? There's a huge opportunity in finance here.
Yeah.
So really what Machinery Partner is as well is a procurement department, it's a bank as well.
Yeah.
You know, the opportunity here is to raise our own capital and help these people buy this machinery.
Was there ever, like, you ever seen the movie The Founder?
Yes.
McDonald's?
Yes.
Was there ever a moment where, like, someone sat you down or you sat down and you were like, I'm not in the machinery business, I'm in the finance business?
Absolutely.
Really?
That's honestly the big learning. You know, luckily, when we went through Propel here, you know, in the Ormo Baths, Propel helped us refine our pitch enough that we got on to Techstars in Boston. And the process of Techstars in Boston really opened up that opportunity. It's like, do you know what? This isn't just me selling equipment to people. This is a fintech company. You know what I mean? Like this is a bank.
Bro, that's
crazy.
We're
building a bank.
I mean, you did incredibly well at Techstars Boston.
What we'd done was something that's never been done before. We actually recruited the managing director of the course to leave Techstars Boston and come on as a co-founder of the company. and it's never been done before in Techstars history. So
he absolutely sniped them.
Yeah, completely.
That's brilliant.
Completely. You know, and which led to obviously, you know, Machinery Partner being on the radar of like David Cohen, who runs Techstars. You know, he's like, who the fuck's this Irish guy?
And why did he steal my guy?
Exactly, you know.
Amazing. So, I mean, your revenue is exceptional. Like, it's unbelievable what you've been able to build. Why did you decide to go for investment then? Was that ever a conversation, or was that always just, no, we're going to get investment?
Absolutely. You know, it's something that we wrestled with all the time. You know, I mean, we're a profitable business.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't need to take on
which
money.
Pretty rare for startups.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
it's
like, look at Spotify, still can't make revenue.
Exactly.
Still can't be profitable, sorry.
Yeah, it's crazy, you know, to have a business that's only a startup when we're already turned over, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars and like we're money in the bank and investors are looking at us going like,
why do you need us?
Why are you raising? It's like, in order for this to get to the size that I want it to get to, investment is imperative.
So what is that size?
We're not building just, you know, a company that's going to turn over a couple of millions. We're looking to really have the first unicorn to come out of the north of Ireland.
Bro.
That's the plan.
I love it.
It's to turn over, you know, a multi-billion dollar business.
Yeah.
That's what we're growing.
Yeah. And I mean, in terms of accolades, correct me if I'm wrong, I think your 4.5 million you're raising will be the biggest ever for a Northern Irish company.
It is. Yeah. That's what we've heard so far. So, happy to be corrected on that, but
challenge accepted. It's like, come at me, bro.
Exactly. But yeah, you know, and it's crazy to think, you know, even this time last year, it was basically me sitting here by myself in the Ormo Baths at a desk with just me working on it, you know.
Crazy, man.
And now, you know, we're hiring like 30 people this year. It's insane.
So back to the investment bit. What do you want specifically investment to bring you? Is it capital so you can grow more quickly? Is it expertise, or what are you looking for here?
Yeah, so really what we want to do is we're using the capital to hire people, and what we're trying to do is build a learning structure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're using this money to write the playbook of how machinery is sold. You know, how these businesses transact with us, you know. So the goal for this round is just to write the playbook of how it's done.
Yeah.
So then we can potentially lift this and put it into a different industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and by the end of it, what we want to do is to start transacting through Machinery Partner Capital, which will be the finance element of the business.
So what other industry do you see this being fit onto the top of?
We really see this as it's not the businesses, it's mm-hmm. the customers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what we're seeing is small businesses find it hard to buy machinery.
Wow.
And that's not just with crushers and screeners. Where we're starting now.
Yeah.
The same way Amazon did with books.
Yeah.
You know, we're starting with crushers and screeners.
Yeah.
Then, you know, agriculture, you've got oil and gas, mm-hmm. even right up to, you know, one of our co-founders, Matt Malloy, who was the VP of marketing for a company called Zipcar.
I know it well. I lived in Manhattan for 3 years and it was perfect. Zipcar everywhere.
So Matt Malloy helped scale that company from 1 million to 100. Epic. And he's now come on board as our chief marketing officer. So, but he went and started a brewery in Dorchester, and he has exactly
putting the Zipcar money to good use.
Exactly. He just opened up a brewery. He never brewed beer before, but you know, it's a really successful brewery now in Dorchester. But he found the same problems buying machinery for his business.
Crazy.
You know, and the more people we talk to, the more people are, even from completely different industries, they're like, that's the same as my industry. That's the same as my industry.
And that's the genius of your name, because you haven't limited yourself.
Exactly. We don't want to limit ourselves. You know, we want to be able to move this to any small business, small and growing businesses that want to buy machinery.
Yeah. I mean, this next question, I mean it with the utmost respect for you. Like, do you see yourself being the guy at the helm of the ship for the next 5 years, for the next 10 years? Do you see yourself taking a step back? What do you personally want to do with this business?
For me, right now, there's nobody better to be leading this business than me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the right person for right now.
Yeah.
And in 5 years, that may not be the case. Yeah. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I'll just have to take every year as it comes.
Yeah, you have to. You know, what other option do you have?
Exactly. You know, but I mean, I wouldn't be against the idea of someone else leading if it comes to a stage where I'm not the best person anymore.
Sure.
You know, the business is more important than my ego. You know, so it's about building this right business, you know, as big as it can be. You know, I'm not going to say that I can lead this the IPO, but, sure, you know, I'm fucking going to give it a try.
Made 100%. You know. So based on that and based on the whirlwind that probably is your life right now, like, what is it like managing a hugely aggressive growing startup in your 30s with kids, with family, global pandemic, insert all the other layers on top of that? Like, how's it going, and how, like, what do you do to keep things going?
It's fucking manic.
It's brutal.
And anyone that tells you otherwise is lying. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, startups are hard.
Yeah.
They're really hard. Like, from a personal perspective, it adds a lot of pressure in the family life, you know, because obviously with most of my business being in the US, I have to work in US hours, you know, so we have investors in San Francisco,
which means
sometimes there's meetings at 12 o'clock at night.
Cool.
That's just the way, you know, you're never off.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, at the moment, it's like, people always say that, you know, as a CEO, you're run about putting out fires all over the place,
know,
and but for us, it's not. It's you're trying to build fire stations so the fires can put themselves out in the future.
Man, I love
you
that.
Know, and that's what it's about. It's about trying to see problems before they happen.
Yeah.
And at this stage, there's fucking problems everywhere.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and the truth is, no one really knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, entrepreneurs will always say, oh yeah, you know, and you listen to all these influencers and all that, but no one has a fucking clue what they're doing, you know.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. And again, so I don't usually underscore stuff so much, but I do just want to be clear here, because I'm actually projecting my own insecurity onto you. Okay.
Of course.
So, like, you don't come from a background of like running big companies. You don't come from even really a management position.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what has been some of the most valuable leadership insights that you've learned and have been able to put into use? Because you're learning all the time, and like, it's a whole new skill set that you just have all of a sudden, you've had to become a CEO.
Yeah.
So what's that journey been like for you?
I mean, like, you know, let's not beat around the bush. I live in a council estate in West Belfast.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, things might change, you know, in the future, but, you know, I'm grounded as to where I come from, you know, and, yeah, this has all been thrust upon me, but I've done it myself. I've put myself in this position where I have to, you know. It's sink or swim.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, I fought for this so hard, and I have to make it work. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's about bettering myself all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I think not coming from it has actually helped, because, you know, obviously we all go through this where, you know, we have this insecurity about ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's really thinking, it's like this imposter syndrome.
Yep.
You know, we all have it, you know, and everyone has it. Anyone who says it don't is a complete liar. You know, I'm going and meeting these people who have built hundreds of million dollars worth of business, you know, and they're giving me advice, and I'm going like, what the fuck am I doing talking to these people? You know, but actually, the more of them I get to talk to, them, like, people don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the best thing you can do is be a decent human. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, talk to people. Just be decent. You know, I remember in Techstars Boston, Techstars hire like a load of associates. Mm-hmm. So they do to help you, you know, and it's through different things. You know, there's finance, there's product, marketing, and these their job is basically to make you look good. And if you need a project on, they'll do it. So I went over to the office, and people were using them dead aggressively. You know, do this and like finish this project. And like there was a girl who was virtual at the end of it, and she was in Hawaii, and yeah, and people were like hounding her at 4:30 a.m. her time to get a project finished because they needed it.
Jeez Louise.
So I like went in the office and they were like all coming over to me, Kieran, what do you want? I like, fuck off, I don't want anything from this. Like, what do you mean? I was like, I don't want anything, fuck off.
Yeah.
And they came over later and says, can we do anything? I says, you can do something. I says, come on out for beers. And they went, well, I says, come on out for beers. So I like brought them all out to the bar and got them drunk. Americans can drink none. So, you know, it was like, just brought them out, bought them a load of drink, got them drunk. And then like, anything I needed, but I got done, you know, and I was like, guys, could you do X, Y, and Z for me?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they're like, no issue. And it was always done. Yeah. And, you know, it's just being decent. You know, people don't do that. They'd be very aggressive, mm-hmm. you know. And I think just being a decent human is the best advice that I can give anyone.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a culture of fear versus a culture of, like, team.
100%.
It's really interesting. Really interesting. Let's see then. There was something I had in my head. Ah, yeah. Do you think that... This is a bit of a weird question, but sure, we'll go with it. Do you think being Irish has helped you?
Without question.
Really?
Without question.
Right, so give me that.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with crushing and screening, you know, it's an Irish industry, mm-hmm. you know, and all the people that have went to the US to do this, they're all Irish, you know. So you'll have these dealers in the most remote area of Texas, and they're Irish, you know.
Yeah,
what I mean?
I love that.
So as soon as I start talking to people, they're like, oh, you're Irish, you know what you're talking about, you know. So there's that initial, you know, that initial inclination. And obviously, having a startup in Boston, there's you know, the big Irish American community around there, you know, so there's a lot you can leverage mm-hmm. within that, you know. And it's been awesome because the Irish American community in over in the US have really been helpful. They've really been coming out and trying to help someone come over there and try to break in, you know.
So awesome. Series of stock questions that we always end each episode with. The first two are brutal, right? I'll be honest with you.
Sweet.
Most challenging moment so far, and how were you able to overcome it?
Most challenging moment was probably bringing on Clement Casalo, who's the managing director of Techstars. Mm. It was bringing someone in who could potentially replace me, you know, and probably should, you know. much, much, much more experienced than I am, you know. And it's really... When I was raising money, it was one of the big questions that people got. You know, why is he not leading the company? Why are you leading the company? So I was creating.
I thought I was being brutal. Investors are next level.
100%. And that's what they were saying. You know, why are you leading the company? And it was just about, you know, reinforcing the idea that right now there's no one better than me in doing this. You know, and this is a company that I built from the ground up.
Yeah.
And, you know, I am literally the best person. So it's been a lot of self-belief, but... You know, obviously there was a lot of doubts, you mm-hmm. know, and people giving me all this advice, and it's great having advice, but it's about stilling that and figuring out what's best for you. So that's probably been the biggest.
But it's also looking at who's giving you the advice. Like, mate, have you built a extremely profitable company like I have?
100%.
Or have you just invested in a few good things? Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
That's great. Flip side of that, then, most successful moment so far.
Probably
you're quick on these.
Yeah.
I tell you.
Probably, you know, actually looking at my bank account and seeing 4.5 million in it was one, you know, like, obviously it's not my fucking money, but you know, starting off with this vision at the start with a young family and explaining to Kleena that potentially I could do this and having that belief and jumping out, and it's like validation at the end of it, you know. So just to say that, you know what, this idea is actually turning into something. I think that's a big thing, because it was a big bet, not just for me, but for Kleena as well, you know, to jump out and try this and start it. And now it's got this stage where, you know, we're turning over money, with money in the bank, and we're starting to build a big team, you know. So that's probably it.
Brilliant, mate. If you could take anyone from Northern Ireland, dead or alive, out for a pint or a cup of coffee,
oh,
who would you take? Where would you take them? Why?
That's a really, really good one. There was an old fucker that used to run about with a lion in the Shore Road.
Wait, give me a second.
Buck Alec.
Buck Alec, yep, that's right.
I would bring Sailor Buck Alec. Town, yep. Yeah, I would bring Buck Alec out for a pint because I would love to know why the fuck he's walking about with a lion and where he got it from.
So this is, legitimately, it's a source of personal curiosity to me. Like, I have talked to loads of people. I remember chatting to the guy, Martin Lynch. He's a playwright. He grew up in Sailor Town. And I was like, did Buck Alec really exist? Because there's still part of me that's like, yeah, that can't be true.
Yeah.
And I've heard every possible scenario of the story. It's like, yeah, the lions didn't have teeth. He ripped the teeth out of them and they were from Dublin Zoo and someone went down to get them for him.
Yeah.
But I would love to know 100% in my heart this is exactly the way things went down.
100%.
But then the other party is like, I do like the wee bit of a mystery there, yeah. And people talk about, they used to eat all the neighborhood cats and all. And you're like, really? I don't know about that. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Apparently, he used to drug the lions as well to make them a wee bit more tame.
I've heard all this as well.
It's crazy.
And it's mental. My granda said that he's seen him before, so that's where I'm taking it from. But I was like, yeah, I would love to know his reasoning behind that.
Yeah.
Seems a bit excessive. Like.
And he, from what I can gather, he seemed to be like an amazing street fighter.
Yeah. I mean, it would remind you of Mike Tyson, really, wouldn't it? Why did Mike Tyson go and get a tiger? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just because he could, I suppose.
On Bible. Well, where would you take Buck Alec?
I'd take him into the top of that new fancy rooftop bar.
Oh, great. Grand Central.
Grand Central. Mm. With the lion.
That would definitely make the papers the next day.
Yep.
Unbelievable. Final question, mate. Bit of a cliche, but I really enjoy ending here. If you could go back to 18-year-old Kieran, you had a couple of minutes of that younger version of yourself, what would you say?
Do fucking nothing different.
Yeah.
Everything that I've done, every mistake I've made has led to the person and everything else that has become. You know, obviously there's a few things that I'd like to fuck off, but sure, yeah. You know, I don't think you can change anything and still be the same.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, you know what, do you.
It is amazing that, like, even in those earlier years, you were already on the path. You didn't even know it.
Exactly.
But you were literally on it.
I mean,
hindsight's 20/20, obviously.
Exactly. You know, and I think, you know, having, you know, like my dad leading me in that sort of direction has instilled that entrepreneurial essence into me, you know. So it was always going to be there.
Yeah. Wee bonus question for you. What's the kindest thing someone's ever done for you?
Probably Clina giving me kids. She'd fucking kill me if I didn't put that in.
Mate, I love that. You're a man who knows the score. You gotta keep the peace at home, don't you?
100%.
Last minute. Well, look, Kieran, honestly, thank you so much for coming in and sharing everything you did. I had an absolute blast.
Thank you, mate.
Yeah, funny stories and a lot of good insights too. So that's a good episode.
Thanks, mate. It's awesome.
Cheers.